Well, welcome back. Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. Young David, good to see you. David Dahl is my producer, and Miss Terry is here. 602-508-0960 if you'd like to weigh in on anything. I was thinking about what to talk about with regard to what's going on across campuses and the universities throughout the United States, and I thought I would revive so many directions to go in, but I thought I'd revivify a piece that I co-authored with Josh Hammer. Josh Hammer is the editor-at-large at Newsweek. We had it published in The American Mind, and it has been republished in a few places elsewhere, like the James Q. Wilson Center, etc. Free speech sense and sensibility. It's precious to see so many college administrators, deans, and presidents now honing principled, absolutist commitments to freedom of speech on their campuses in defense of protest. When campuses were hosting people like Dennis Prager or Charles Murray or Charlie Kirk or Riley Gaines or even federal appellate court judges, the messages that used to ban or chase them off campus were hate has no home here, or the juice is not worth the squeeze. Defamatory characterizations on the part of biased third parties, such as the Southern Poverty Law Center, against these speakers as white nationalists or worse, were used as evidence that they should not be, did not deserve any free speech protection. Hate speech is not protected speech became the bray of leftist academics and legislators across the whole country. To anyone even marginally familiar with First Amendment doctrine, hate speech has long been held to be constitutionally protected speech because in the absence of a direct and specific threat of violence, it has no easily defined and applicable legal standard. Legally speaking, hate speech does not exist. The problem with the leftist censors' positions, as most Americans used to understand, is that one man's legitimate policy perspective voiced in an open and democratic society cannot form the basis of another's demand to be protected from it. Open debate on political concerns should not constitute a transubstantiation of words into violence, thus rendering them subject to censorship. Nevertheless, college presidents, administrators, and deans have had no problem washing their hands of the shutting down of speakers whose positions offended delicate left-wing sensibilities. Not anymore, it seems. Since the Hamas pogrom on October 7th of last year, American campuses have been rife with the kind of evil that is not merely emblematic of heated policy debate, but is instead straight out of 1930s-era Germany. What are euphemistically identified as pro-Palestinian protests are calls for violence against the Jewish people. Celebratory imagery of Stars of David in trash cans with phrases like glory to our martyrs and from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free, are all overt calls to sectarian violence. From the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free is in fact the only explicit call to genocide that receives tolerance and even respect in polite society today. The United States in the year 2023 and 2024 has a perverted understanding of freedom of speech. Joe Biden said the impetus for his run for president was his abhorrence of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. Whence came the idea that neo-Nazis had the right to march in Charlottesville in 2017? Perhaps it came from the misbegotten notion that their spiritual forebears had the unambiguous moral or legal right to march in Skokie, Illinois, in the late 1970s. The ardent relativism that has surrounded such assertions of free speech rights is a surrender to what the First Amendment was never meant to protect. Vile statements wholly untethered from the pursuit of truth, which was the original impetus for legally protected freedom of speech in the first place. This relativism, adopted by liberals of both parties, is a capitulation to the notion that everything in the marketplace of ideas has equivalent inherent value. A sounder view, one explicated by Justice Samuel Alito in his courageous solo dissenting opinions in both United States v. Stevens in 2009 and Snyder v. Phelps in 2011, is one less grounded in the idiosyncratic and self-satisfied words of an individual provocateur and more grounded in the telos of a free speech regime that has existed since the Academy of Ancient Greece, the pursuit of truth. when purported contributions to the public discourse exceed substantive dissident speech and become unmoored from anything remotely smacking of the pursuit of truth, they are liable to be treated as something less than fully protected speech qua speech for either moral or legal or tort or criminal law purposes. Calls from jihad sympathizers to exterminate the Jews of Israel, or for that matter to gas the Jews anywhere they can be found the world over, would certainly fit into this category. As Justice Alito explained in his Stevens and Snyder dissents, the First Amendment was meant to protect a vast array of thought and belief, but they are thought and belief to be offered in a marketplace of ideas dedicated to perpetuating and securing certain ends of governance, such as the blessings of liberty and a republican form of government that the Constitution invokes. The First Amendment was not meant to protect anything or everything, and certainly not as a suicide pact allowing for the perfectly equal moral or legal claims of, say, a Joe Biden and a Donald Trump on the one hand, and an Ali Khamenei and a Hassan Nasrallah on the other hand. They simply are not entitled the same protection and are not the same kinds of speech. The Constitution was never meant to yield to a liberal marketplace of fascism, communism, or Islamism, or explicit calls to racial or ethnic mass murder. Our founders were not moral or political relativists. They saw our Constitution as necessary not merely to tolerate, but to affirmatively secure substantive justice. As scholars such as Hadley Arkus, Walter Burns, and others have explained, the Constitution, which was designed to protect particular ends, was not designed and could not have been designed to stand for an equality of every possible political outcome, especially one that might ultimately supplant the very republican form of government that the Constitution itself mandates. That would make it not a constitution. Today, in a perverse twist, political speech that debates the best opinions about how we govern ourselves with regard to political contentions that have been with us since time immemorial have been censored on college campuses. When it comes to the war in Israel and Gaza, Americans living under our Constitution might disagree on the merits of, I don't know, a U.S.-prodded ceasefire, whether Hamas supporting foreign students ought to have their visas revoked, or any number of other public policy issues. But bloodthirsty marches on behalf of genocide must not be confused with morally or legally legitimate free speech under our constitutional order. Our regime recognizes these not as differences in the degree of would-be speech, but in the kind of speech. Such a misunderstanding of our commitments to freedom, speech, and plain decency have led us to this ironic pass, along with the exclusion from study of the importance of an open society dedicated to equality, dedicated to pluralism, dedicated to equal religious, ethnic, and other rights. You only get that from the West. Debates about men being allowed to use women's locker rooms or arguments about meritocracy seem to be intolerable on these campuses these days. But marches, takeovers, and insurrections with incantations to genocide, by contrast, well, those, they'll be considered sacred. And that's why we're at where we're at. 602-508-0960. Let's see. Let's go to Jack, who's in Anthem. Hi, Jack. Hello, Jack. How are you?
How you doing?
I'm fine.
First of all, my parents came from the old country, Armenia. They were in the genocide in 1915. You heard about that, correct?
Of course, sir. Yes.
All right. Well, anyways, all the stuff that's happening that what the Hamas did to the babies and all that kind of stuff. Now it's already in the United States. These people in these colleges, can they vote, or are they allowed to vote, or are they citizens?
Well, it's interesting. We don't fully know. Thank you, Jack. We don't fully know. It's an interestingly high number of foreign students at these colleges. In some cases, 20 or up to 30%, particularly at the Ivy Leagues. Now, of course, they don't have the right to vote as non-citizens, but anyone over the age of 18 or older in America can vote, regardless of what they say in their non-voting time. But Alan Dershowitz raised a really interesting question, and I think it's one that we're not prepared to answer. I am, not too many are, which is when professors and students say, I am Hamas, I support Hamas, when they say those things, how far of a leap, how far of a bridge is it to cross to think they might actually join Hamas, which is a terrorist organization? That is the question that we're going to have to wrestle with. I'd like to. No one in the Democratic Party wants to. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. 602-508-0960 is the number. Mike is in Carefree. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Seth.
How are you?
Having a good day?
Yeah, how about you?
Yeah. Good, thank you.
Good.
My thought was, you know, it's incredibly difficult to prosecute and to convict for treason, but one of the only two or three ways that it can be done is if you admit treason.
Yes.
And to admit that you are a member of a group that has sworn to destroy America would certainly be treason, and you're admitting it. I mean, any foreign person who says they're part of Hamas should be gone, and every single one of those students who says they're a member of Hamas should be prosecuted for treason.
You know, it's a great point. It is an enemy of the United States. It's also on our terrorism. It's on our official list of states of terrorist entities that the State Department puts out. There's no question about that. And I have been arguing that, you know, there's this whole controversy about whether the police should go in or not. The local police should go in to disrupt the protests. And the students, evidently the administrators, don't want the police to be doing that. I have a compromise. Don't send in the police. Send in the FBI, because there are material support for terrorism statutes, both in New York and many states, but at the federal level. And everything that the Students for Justice in Palestine puts out seems to fall within the material support for terrorism federal law. They are providing material support for terrorism and terrorists, including giving financial services, lodging, safe houses, and transportation. They could be indicted on any number of material support for terrorism violations, it seems to me, Mike. This, again, like with everything else, isn't about ability. It's about will. Just no one wants to do it. And I think it's unfortunate, because I think you're going to get more of it. I also think you're going to find either activation of or increased membership in Hamas, if not Hezbollah, cells here in America.
Well, the thing that I think needs to be challenged is, if you're truly a revolutionary and you're willing to give up something, then they should say, you know, your career ends today in college. You lose your money, you don't get a degree, you're gone. And if they truly believe in that cause, that shouldn't bother them.
It's so interesting. I'm watching. Really, you're right. You're totally right. I'm watching these students who have occupied Hamilton Hall at Columbia and renamed it. And they are holding press conferences outside. That's how ridiculous the leadership at Columbia is. It's allowing the media in to let them have press conferences. And these students, one after the other, say, we have made very clear demands. And our demands are, you know, divestment and so on and so forth. First of all, who are they to make the demands? I don't know that they're the majority of the university. Columbia has, what, probably 30,000 students. I don't think there are 30,000 students at Hamilton Hall or on the grounds. That's point one. But point two is they keep saying, we don't want our tuition dollars going to fund the state of Israel, or, you know, funding arms that support the state of Israel. Well, fine. No one's forcing you to go to Columbia. You're absolutely right, Mike. Take one for the team. Put your money where your mouth is. Find a school that doesn't have investments where you don't like them and go there. It's an amazing claim of privilege and arrogance to say, I, as a 19-year-old whose parents are paying $90,000 like so many other 19-year-olds before me and along with me, have the right to tell this institution that I wanted to come to and signed a contract with what it gets to invest in. That's not the way most of the world works.
And additionally, you start look at the pictures of them breaking into Hamilton Hall.
Yeah.
And put them side by side with January 6th. Which one's more violent?
Well, I'll tell you, it's an easy answer. That's actually a really easy answer. illegally taking over a building on January 6th is a threat to democracy and maybe the greatest threat to democracy since the Civil War. Illegally breaking into, destroying, and taking over a building on behalf of Hamas is the essence of democracy. Does that clear it up for you?
Yes.
Okay. You need to know the rules, Mike. Those are the rules.
Yeah. Forgive me.
Yeah. No, you lost your mind for a moment there, thinking that the law was supposed to be equal and equitably applied based on the actions of the violator of it. That's not the way it works around here, Mike. Not in 21st century America. In 21st century America, you have preferred criminals and you have preferred victims, and you have agendas that are preferred and you have agendas that are unpreferred. And until you understand that matrix, you will never be able to have a career in law enforcement or law.
Yeah, I'm glad that I'm old enough to not need that.
When you look at these campuses, though, and you see these kids, I was making the point yesterday, it's easy for me to, you know, and you and I and the rest of the audience to have some sarcastic comments about some of this because the moment does call for it in part. But there's a deep sadness, too. Do you feel it? I do. There's a deep sadness about this youth that is so lost, empty of soul, empty of brain. And I just the question we can't possibly answer is, I wonder if in about 3, 5, 10 years, they'll look back and say, my God, what was I marching on behalf of? Today, the president of Iran was praising these student protesters. Is that the side they really want to be on?
Well, I went to a liberal arts college. And in the same format, we had William F. Buckley and Jerry Rubin.
Right.
And they both gave their spiels, and there were people going rah-rah for Jerry Rubin, and he gave me the creeps. But, you know, people sat down, and people listened, and they had a conversation. There is no conversation any longer. Mm-mm. This is strictly tyranny.
Yeah, and where did that come from? That came from what I was saying in the opening part of my monologue, my piece with Josh Hammer. That came from, well, the rules that you obviously never learned, which is the rules that changed over the last 30, 35 years, which is one side gets to present, the other side does not get to present. That changed about 30 years ago. So you can't have Dennis Prager on your campus, but you can have spokesmen on behalf of terrorist organizations. You can't have a picture of or a flag that says "Don't tread on me" on your college campus. You know, the old anti-colonialist revolutionary flag of 1775, the Gadsden flag. Right? You can't carry that, but you can carry the Hamas flag. And it seems to me that it's that whole notion of we are here to indoctrinate, we are not here to teach, is what got us off on the wrong path. Started in the early 80s in earnest, and it's been really bad for a really long time. This is the culmination of it, I think.
Well, look at the literature coming out of people in the last 30 years, and look at the grammar. They've thrown out the rules of grammar because it doesn't matter to them about the accuracy of speech, which was so important in the past, because they're just going to bludgeon it and make it mean whatever they want it to mean.
And by the way, there are schools, don't you know, that if you try and correct someone's grammar, you will be called a racist or a bigot or engaging in the badgery of white supremacy. Of course you will. You know that. Thank you, Mike. God bless. Godspeed. Drive safely. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. John Dombrowski brings us our culture and economy update. He is the president and founder of Grand Canyon Planning Associates, website grandcanyonplanning.com. Great website, great place to go to reach out to John and to learn about what Grand Canyon Planning might be able to do for you. John, how are you this Tuesday?
Fantastic, Seth. Thank you.
Let me run two things by you here. I'm glad to hear that, by the way. Let me run two things by you here. Mm-hmm. Home prices soar even higher despite higher mortgage rates. This is interesting, yes?
Yeah, it is interesting, right? Because we keep hearing that rates are going up, and you would just imagine that this is going to slow down the growth of real estate in this country. But, boy, for some reason, It is not happening. We saw home prices jumping 6.4% year over year. Now, this is, of course, on an annual basis from last February through this February. And that's according to S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller, the National Home Price Index. And it was 6% the month prior on an annual run rate. And it's really interesting to see that this is continuing to happen even as rates are rising. And we've, again, saw rates again go up today. And just in the last quarter, mortgage rates have gone up about 1%. So still happening out there with home sales. And, you know, one of the other sides of this, too, Seth, is that it's becoming harder and harder for the first-time home buyer to try to buy a home. But what's really driving these prices up is that there's a shortage of housing. Mm-hmm. We just are not building enough housing to cover the demand that's out there right now.
Well, it is interesting, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for the younger people to enter those markets as these prices rise.
Yeah.
And we thought, as obviously general economic theory would have you think that the prices would come down. But it turns out there still are a lot of people, I suppose, with a lot of money, or at least enough money to keep the market to keep those prices increasing. Yes.
So we know that there are a lot of people leaving some of the other areas of the country, such as California.
Yeah.
And we know that the prices in California are elevated. A lot of the people that they sell that home in California, they have all this money. They come to areas like Arizona, as an example, or other areas of the country, and they can buy a lot more for what they sold.
Yeah.
And now they've got excess money. So we're seeing that that's also another reason why people are driving prices higher. And a lot of these transactions are cash. People are just coming in and paying cash for properties rather than borrowing.
Mm-hmm.
And until we start to see rates fall, which we're seeing, you know, inflation is still sticky. It's still expensive to buy just about everything out there. So, you know, we may not see rate cuts until later this year in December, or not even at all this year, depending on what happens. The Fed's meeting right now to talk about it. Another interesting side of this is that, you know, when we had COVID, this is where we really saw this push, right, in 2021, 2022, where the real estate market took off and we had extremely high inflation. And we saw people leaving the inner cities and moving out into the suburbs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was driving the prices up in these areas in the suburbs. But now we're starting to see, as people are going back to work, back to the office, that we're starting to see things shift again.
Yeah.
And people are moving back closer to where they work.
Yeah. Housing is a good place to look to get an indicator mm-hmm. of where the economy is. So too is McDonald's, believe it or not. No, it
yes.
is, right? I mean, it
yeah,
is an
right.
interesting
no.
cultural indicator of the economic condition of our country.
Yeah.
And they've got a problem.
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting is I'm hearing all these reports. I don't really go to McDonald's much. You and I just talked about this a little while ago. You know, every once in a while I might pop in there every other year or two, whatever it is, because I'm just in a hurry to get something to eat real quick, and then McDonald's happens to be there, but I don't seek it out. But a lot of people do.
Yep.
And the cost, even at McDonald's now, from what I'm hearing, is so much higher than what it used to be. Now, of course, you know, we had a 40-year high of inflation, 9.1% in mid-2022. But even though the Fed's trying to get that down to 2%, they're in the 3.5% range right now. But food costs and labor costs seem to really be driving the price, even at these fast food places. And McDonald's is one of them.
Yeah.
And you know, they reported this week, and it was not as good as what was expected by the analysts. And the stock price is getting hit because of it, because they're having a challenge getting that price down on food.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Interesting stat for you. 85.
Yeah, but this is.
Yeah, no. Well, here's an interesting stat. About 85% of Americans eat at McDonald's at least once a year.
There you go.
That's pretty. Well, that's pretty.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
That's market saturation for you. Thank you, John.
It sure is.
Yes,
you bet. Okay, check out our website, GrandCanyonPlanning.com. Securities and advisory services offered through Creative One Securities LLC, a member of FINRA and SIPC, and an investment advisor, Grand Canyon Planning Associates LLC, and Creative One Securities LLC, are not affiliated. Thank you, Seth.
Well done, sir. Thank you. McDonald's. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960, coming in with Glenn Campbell's Rhinestone Cowboy. Young David, have you ever seen David Hasselhoff's version of it? It's worth looking up.
Only thanks to you.
Isn't it fun?
I'd like my 3 minutes back, please.
Oh, really? You thought it was that bad?
No, I'm not a fan.
Okay.
No.
All right. No. All right. What have you been up to?
I'd
what
much
do you
rather see the car from the show do it.
Kit?
Kit, sorry. Kit.
From Knight Rider?
Show. Yes, yes.
Yeah. It's that bad?
I'm not a fan.
Okay.
I'm not a fan. David Hasselhoff is known for his good looks and his crime-fighting abilities, but singing is not one of his talents.
And saving people from drowning.
Yeah.
Baywatch.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Baywatch. Anything else you would like to share from us from the life of David? That's interesting.
Interesting.
Cooking anything?
Interesting person. Well, I discussed what I was cooking with you yesterday, and you soundly trounced it.
What was it?
Well, I'm probably going to be cooking collard greens and fried green tomatoes
tonight. Yeah, right.
Tonight,
we are trouncing that. Yes. Let's soundly trounce
that. You've trounced it, and you don't even know how that's cooked.
Give us some Ronald Reagan on how to handle protesters.
I would like to discuss this, because I was pointing out to you earlier today that this whole campus issue has been around since the late 60s.
And yeah.
Governor Reagan had to deal with a protest at Berkeley in 1967, shortly after he was elected governor, in which he dealt with people who were protesting the construction of something on campus. Yeah. And here's how he responded.
Those people told you for days in advance that if the university sought to go ahead with that construction, they were going to physically destroy the university.
Why did you negotiate many times?
Negotiate? What is to negotiate? What is?
University is a public institution.
That's right. But the university,
its own community, and for the community of Berkeley that live around it.
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
Yeah. I'm sick and tired of the argument about whether some effort to enforce law and order is going to escalate anything at all. Plain truth of the matter is this has to stop, and it has to stop like the day before yesterday.
That's a great point. Hold it off, David. That's a great point that this notion that bringing in the police will exacerbate the situation. The police are about law and order. It seems to me there is no less orderly and more lawless place than these college campuses right now. They could use a little bit of law and order. And it wouldn't have to be they think you have to arrest everyone. You don't have to arrest everyone, although you could. Ron DeSantis was channeling Ronald Reagan, governor of Florida.
Country in some respects for what we have to offer when people come. We're also leading on how to handle things like university decorum and these protests. And I look around what's happening at, like, Columbia. I look around what's happening at places like Columbia, and the inmates are allowed to run the asylum. It doesn't work that way. In the University of Florida, Florida State, all universities have been very strong in saying, you know, you can say what you want, but you don't have the right to commandeer territory. You don't have the right to harass students or faculty or any of that. And if you do violate code of conduct, we're going to show you the door. You will be expelled. And that's what should be done in every part of this country. So we're going to continue to do that and make sure that we are upholding basic standards of conduct and basic standards of decency.
Now, you know what the problem is here when he talks about the inmates? This is a crucial problem and elemental to it. When he talks about the inmates taking over the asylum, the asylums have been long gone. They've been long taken over by the inmates. Look at the professors. Look at what the professors are doing. Look at the professors standing in front as human shields of those students and saying equally stupid things and saying equally genocidal things. The professors are part of the inmates who have taken over the asylum. The normal people have mostly left the universities, at least when it comes to faculty and administration. People with their heads pointed forward have mostly left because they can't take it. They have exercised their freedom of choice to work elsewhere. You wonder why there are so many great scholars who write and don't have university affiliations but have think tank affiliations or organizational or nonprofit affiliations, it's because they can't get jobs and don't want to get jobs at the universities anymore because they can't do their work anymore, which is pursuing their discipline, pursuing their truth, articulating a position from what they have found and what they have discovered. They're not welcome. They're not welcome. So I wouldn't say that the inmates have taken over the asylum. I will say that rather, instead, the asylum is all that exists anymore, and the inmates are throughout. And I can't think of more than five examples where it's not the case, plus every school in Florida where it's not the case, that it's all taken over by lunatics, a lunatic fringe that is no longer a fringe. It is the main part of the university. The main parts of the universities are insane, sociopathic, and disoriented. Disoriented in their morals, disoriented in their education. You know, it's two things I wanted to raise from that, thinking of Reagan and DeSantis. One of my chief criticisms of Ronald Reagan, for as great a president as he was, is that a key failure was to take a vice president on who could further perpetuate the Reagan Revolution, further continue, further extend the Reagan Revolution beyond his own tenure. George H.W. Bush was just not constitutionally or ideologically capable of doing that, and so it faltered. So we think about, and there's a lot of discussion right now about who Donald Trump should pick as the vice president, as his vice president. And the analyses go, you know, run the gamut from someone who can help him win, someone who can moderate him on this or bolster him on that, someone who might help him gain a state he might not. The usual stuff that you think about in choosing a vice president. I think the criterion I would be looking at right now is who, because he's only going to be able to serve four more years if he's elected, God please, who would best be able to continue, perpetuate, give ongoing life to the Republican Party's cause, whether it's MAGA or America First or Trump or whatever you want to call it. Who would be the vice president that could best take it to the next four and ideally 8 years, starting in 2029, to avoid the mistake of Ronald Reagan's? And oddly enough, you know, I would not have predicted, but there's a lot of talk about the man whose audio we just played, Ron DeSantis. There's a lot of talk about Ron DeSantis being a potential vice presidential choice for Donald Trump. And indeed, Ron DeSantis has endorsed Donald Trump. No great surprise there, but welcome nonetheless. I wonder if you all think that that's a good idea or who. There was a time when people said, I wish their fight would be over and they'd just run together. I wonder if people still feel that way or if they feel there's a stronger vice presidential candidate for Donald Trump. I'd love your ideas on this and calls. Please call 602-508-0960. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, portions of which are brought to you by our good friends at Y Refi. With Y Refi, they offer an investment, a secure investment. It's in a collateralized portfolio, and they invest with you, control and flexibility, where you can take income or not, where you can compound it, whatever you like. With YRefi, there are absolutely no fees, and there is no attack on principal if you ever need your money back with YRefi. Of course, you get a monthly statement with no surprises. You can visit them. They're based here locally on Chauncey Lane in North Phoenix. You won't get a sales pitch or be asked to sign a thing. But best of all with YRefi is that you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return, and it's not correlated to the Federal Reserve or the stock market. If you don't visit them in person, check them out online at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then refy.com, or give them a call at 888-YREFI-24. Dan is in Chandler. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Seth. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah. How are you?
Good. So anyway, you bring up the interesting topic of who should be Trump's running mate, and my personal favorite is Byron Donald.
Congressman from Florida, yeah.
Correct. He is a true MAGA Republican. He is sharp as a pin, articulate as anyone, and he he's also just sort of representative of the whole new breed of young, successful black men who are focused on success rather than victimhood. And I think that it would just be a wonderfully balanced ticket.
He is he's very articulate and very good. Do you prefer him to, if we're going to look for categories in the minority community, do you prefer him to Tim Scott?
In a way, I do, because although I like Tim Scott very much and would be very happy if he were selected, there's something kind of soft about him.
Uh-huh.
I think Tim Scott would be great for the evangelical community,
mm-hmm.
although, frankly, I don't think he's going to bring in too many new people. If you'll excuse the expression, I think a lot of independents might sort of view him as a bit of an Uncle Tom. I don't think it's true. I don't believe that. But I think he kind of can have that impression. And I think he just also may, may be a little soft in certain ways, whereas Byron Donald is very clear in his ideology.
He totally is. Brian Donalds is verite. Do me a favor, Dan. Go to whatever you use, YouTube or whatever video player, and look at Tim Scott on The View, if you haven't seen his interview there.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah,
remember
it's
that.
Pretty
yeah.
damn impressive, I got to say. It's pretty damn impressive.
Oh, I have no problem with him at all.
It's
I'd
a good,
very
but they're all good thoughts. We of course, have a little bit of a hanging problem with two people from Florida. I think it can be overcome, but it does niggle at us a little bit. All right, 602-5, thank you, Dan. 602-508-0960. Any other thoughts on Donald Trump's vice presidential pick? I'm fascinated in what you think and whether Ron DeSantis would be okay with you or even better.